Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Tom Roddy. Tom, how are you doing? It's been a long time since you've been with us.
It has. And it's a shame it can't be done in the studio face to face, but there we go. But yeah, very well. Yourself?
Yes, very, very well, Tom. How have you found post-lockdown or post-restart, shall I say, with football resuming? How have you found it all?
Yeah, oh, it's been brilliant, actually. It's sort of a, I think it's a sort of renewed appreciation of kind of the job and also just football in general, really. I remember when the Bundesliga came back and everyone was kind of, not everyone, some people were sort of saying it wasn't that exciting. But I think with the Premier League and with the Championship, it's been much better. I think it's been a lot better than anyone expected it to be, even.
I think you might be right. Gregor, how are you keeping?
I'm good, Nat. How are you?
Yes, I am. I'm doing very, very well.
Getting excited about Brentford?
Oh, Gregor, I don't even know. Do you know I am? I'm so excited, but it's still that annoying thing of West Brom and Leeds are not doing their bit. They're not losing right now. So it's a bit frustrating.
It's getting close, and I enjoyed Mr. Frank's kind of tactical masterclass during the drinks break when he got out of the tactics board and he started pointing everyone.
Do you know what? It's interesting you mentioned that. We should just refer to it, shouldn't we? The second half of the game against Charlton, Brentford are 1-0 down. They have the water break, as they're meant to have. And Thomas Frank brings out, as you say, the magnetic tactics board, which I have never seen a manager do, obviously, on a pitch. Is that right? Is that taking it a little bit too far? What did you think, Gregor?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, Chris Wilder had said, I think, in the last round of fixtures too, that, football is now a game of four quarters. Because it disrupts the flow of the game so much, and it allows, the drinks break is almost an excuse for a manager to make their points tactically. And that's what Thomas Frank did. You know, he pulled at the board and he was very sort of animated. He was pointing at side Benrahma quite a lot in the front three, and he was pointing at the spaces they should be attacking. And then obviously they changed the game in that last quarter. So yeah, it's interesting. And the substitute rule looks like it's going to be kept. I really hope that this isn't kept too, because I think it does alter the dynamics of the game, alters the flow of the game.
As you say, I think a lot of managers have raised that they're not quite happy with it. What do you make of it all, Tom? Are you in favour of these water breaks? And are you? There were some dissenting voices, I have to say, that didn't think Thomas Frank was right bringing out a tactics board.
I don't think I have no issue with Thomas Frank, who I'm a big admirer of. I have no issue with him doing that, because I think when managers and players are given these opportunities, they'll take them. There's no rules to say you can't do that. I think when they introduce them, I understand why they introduce them. We didn't expect to be looking outside on a middle of July today, and it's cold and wet. But there have been few games. I remember that Southampton Arsenal game where it was boiling hot, but there have been few games where it's actually been necessary to have a drinks break. But you could have had the foresight and put the drinks at the other side of the pitch, and not had the coaches having that sort of timeout that it's turned into. So I certainly hope it doesn't stick around.
Tom, I knew there was a reason why I liked you, and I knew there was a reason why you were on this pod today, and that is because you, like me, believe Thomas Frank is an innovator.
I wondered where you were going with that, Nat. You don't usually say that.
Do you know what? We've got loads coming up, as Tom actually will bring us some exciting news for Chelsea fans, and we tackle the controversial subject of changing club allegiances.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
There's loads of action to get our teeth stuck into, but let's kick off with Manchester City. The headline in the Times today reads, "Brilliant Silva helps City run riot," as David Silva put in a man-of-the-match performance to help Manchester City sweep aside Newcastle 5-0 at the Etihad. City had 74% of possession. They fired off 23 shots and had a 93.7% pass success rate, a record since Opta began gathering passing data 17 years ago. And at the centre of it all was Mr. Silva. Two assists, a hand in City's second goal, and even getting on the score sheet himself with a curling free kick. It, of course, takes a lot to outshine Kevin De Bruyne in City's midfield, but Silva managed it last night. Tom, how eye-catching was his performance?
Yeah, it was incredible, wasn't it? I mean, we do the ratings for games in the paper for pretty much every game, and I remember a few years ago someone saying to me a kind of general idea of how to go about it was everyone starts on a six, and if you see them do a couple of things good, they bump up to a seven. If you see them do a couple of things bad, pretty bad, you bump them down to a five. That performance from Silva was easily a nine. I mean, and I think mainly because, like you said, Nat, the two assists he got and the goal he scored, all of which were brilliant. But I think I'm right in saying he had a hand in everything, every goal that they did. But it was also the pressurising, which has become, you've seen players in the Guardiola era having to, players who you thought may have fell by the wayside with Sergio Aguero, who have sort of tapped into what Guardiola wants, gone along with him. And when you think Silva's leaving, when you think he's 34 years old and he's still nicking the ball high up the pitch and setting up attacks, he's just a brilliant player.
Yeah, he certainly is. And we'll talk about him in more detail. But Gregor, when a team puts in such a dominant display as City did against Newcastle, does it make their previous result, and of course I'm referring to that defeat to Southampton, even more baffling?
It does, yeah. But actually, I mean, if you look at the stats of the game, both games they had roughly 74% of the ball, which, you know, they dominated as always. And they had more attempts on goal against Southampton. They had 26 and they had 23 against Newcastle. So, you know, I think it really was boiling down to the finishing. And probably to a performance like Silva's too, because, you know, as Tom said, he did have a hand in pretty much every goal. The first goal in particular, it was like, you know, it's this move that's become so familiar with Guardiola, and Silva is always so central to it, where, you know, the ball is played out to Foden, and he always takes up these little pockets of space in between the lines, but when the ball goes wide like that, he darts inside. It's like an underlap almost, inside down the side of the 18-yard box, and it's so hard to mark because the fullback's going out wide to Foden, and it means the opposition are reliant upon a midfielder tracking Silva's run, and they rarely do. So he gets in the box and he's the best there is at picking out a man in the box. So, you know, he did that, and I think the second was almost a carbon copy, except it was Silva to Foden to De Bruyne who made the same run down the box. So. It's really hard to pinpoint why. Guardiola said after the Southampton game why they're finishing on occasion is kind of blunt, and I think often it happens when Aguero's not in the team, whether he's injured or not, and sometimes, you know, when you have a performance like Silva's, who's kind of laid several goals on a plate and scored a free kick, then, you know, that wins the game for you.
Well, Silver topped the charts for touches, 136, passes, 112, opposition half passes of 65, duels 14, possession gained 6, tackles 2, shots 4 and assists 2 in the game. My goodness, you can just purr over all of his stats. And he's also now registered 10 or more assists in all 10 of his seasons at Manchester City. Even the compere for the night at the Etihad couldn't keep pace with Silver when he was announcing in injury time that Silver had won the Man of the Match award because he'd been involved in his 150th league goal. The 34-year-old Spaniard ruined it by making 151 when he set up Raheem Sterling for City's fifth. Departing at the end of the season, the 34-year-old did tweet after the game, "I'm going to miss this team." And he also used a blue heart emoji. Let me come to you first, Tom. It's probably the inevitable question, but we have to ask it. Where do you think he ranks in the greatest midfielders we've seen in the Premier League?
I don't think there are many harder questions to answer than that. And I think there are. It's such a nuanced question because of, you know, he's so different to someone like, say, an N'Golo Kanté or a Roy Keane. But I think for the level of consistency and the way in which he's kind of represented the way in which City have evolved over the years, from first winning the title, he was such a key figure in that, to being such an influential figure who Guardiola rightly purrs over. And you see as well, Phil Foden now, I mean, he was tweeting last night as well about learning from Silver. And you do see similarities, the way in which both of them are constantly checking around them. Maybe they constantly have an idea, a picture in their head of what's around them, the options. Where he ranks, I mean, I would say he's got to be in the top five for the level of consistency. But, you know, it's such a congested field with the likes of Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, Yaya Toure. I mean, even, you know, there are the people he's played alongside with Kevin De Bruyne and Yaya Toure. They'd be contenders for a top five, top ten as well. So even his teammates, two of his teammates should be in there as well.
Mm. Gregor, do you think in some ways we won't truly know what we are missing until we have no longer a David Silva in the Premier League?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Tom's absolutely right there. It's almost, if you're trying to rank him, it's a matter of taste. If, you know, someone like Steven Gerrard is an all-action box-to-box midfielder, and Lampard, who's the ultimate at time and runs into the box and scoring goals, Paul Scholes kind of can spray balls left, right and centre. Patrick Vieira and Keane, they're kind of, you know, the engine room and the sort of heart and soul of the team. But for a technician, for an actual technician, you know, master of the football, and as Tom said, sort of someone who's a bit of an emblem of the journey that Manchester City have been on, because he's been there for throughout, along with Kompany. You know, he is right up there. He has to be right up there, and I think it will be a case where it's another player that Manchester City will almost find it impossible to replace. You know, Kevin De Bruyne is a wonderful midfielder, one of the best in the world, and he's still in his prime. Foden is developing, and the way he's gliding around the pitch at the moment, he's going from strength to strength. But neither of them are David Silva, and I think as they found it so hard to replace Kompany, they will find it almost impossible to replace Silva.
Well, since joining from Valencia in 2010, Silva's gone on to win 4 Premier League titles, 2 FA Cups and 5 League Cups, and could yet end his time at the club with more silverware. Since his Premier League debut, Silva heads the charts with 92 assists and 790 chances created. That's more than any other player in that period. And after the game, Pep Guardiola was asked how he'd like to see Silva honoured by the club. He said, "This club has had many incredible top players. Zabaleta, Hart, Kompany, Silva, Aguero, these types of guys. This group of players helped this club be where it is. After this kind of thing, we name a street, a pitch. And what he has done is incredible, fantastic, not just for the game today, for the last 10 years. What we want is for the people to come back to the Etihad for a game for him as one of the legends of the club." So it seems as though that there will be a David Silva testimonial game to come. Does he deserve a lot more than that, though, Tom?
Guardiola talking about a street and pitch. Of course, that is what they did for Company. There's a pitch named after Company, and I think even with Silva, Company is still more representative of the success that City have had in the journey they've been on. So I think their problem is that, you know, the likes of Arsenal having Thierry Henry outside the Emirates, that's a completely obvious choice. With City, there are so many key players in that period and more to come now, because Gregor made a really good point earlier about it depends on your taste in player, where they rank. And for me, I like Kevin De Bruyne more than I like David Silva, because I think he could play in absolutely any team and he can play in pretty much any position. I think he's the ultimate midfielder, but segueing a little bit. But so yes, I don't know if he certainly deserves more. What they can do, I'm not so sure. I think they'll have to have a mural, or it'll be hard to get into the Etihad with all the statues around the ground.
So very, very true.
He wouldn't. The thing is, though, like with Silva, you wouldn't imagine that he would want anything too kind of overstated. You know, he's very he barely gives any interviews. I remember Gary Neville saying not so long ago, he's like, I live in Manchester. I don't think I've ever seen him out in Manchester. I've never seen him in a restaurant. I hardly know what his voice sounds like. He just, you know, despite him being on that whole journey, he's just a very understated footballer who loves playing football, loves playing for Manchester City. And he really kind of shuns everything else that goes along with that. So I don't really think, you know, I think the biggest thing that he will want, and the supporters will want, is to be able to say farewell. You know, this is so sad that his kind of time at the club is ending like this, at a time when the fans can't, you know, give him a really, really good send-off. And I'm sure when he comes back and when it's safe for everyone to do so, that will be enough for him to kind of to move on to the next stage in his career, whatever that may be.
Just a final point on maybe whether or not he gets a statue or whatever. Where do you both stand on statues? I know, for example, West Ham have mooted the idea of a statue outside the London Stadium of the great Bobby Moore, Sir Geoff Hurst and Martin Peters. Not necessarily gone down that well with West Ham fans, but maybe that's more to do with the fact that they're not quite in love with the London Stadium. But do we feel like statues are the right way to honour players? Or is it better to, as Pep Guardiola says, name a pitch, name a street, name a stand after a player? Tom, do you have a preference or does it not matter to you?
I think I prefer statues. I just think that the tricky thing is these days is that you do, like I said before, you at City, there are so many players. I don't think you could pick one out of those players to be worthy of a statue ahead of the others. And Silver Street sounds a little bit funny, so I'm not too sure about that.
But Gregor, you'd like a bronze statue of yourself, surely?
No, I don't think so. I've never really seen one. You end up like Ronaldo's one, looking sort of monstrous. Yeah, I think, you know, the memory of the way he plays football is going to be enough for most fans, I think.
Is the one blot on his CV, Tom, the fact that he hasn't won the Champions League?
Well, I suppose it would be, I think he's the kind of player who would be totally worthy of it. And it would be the icing on the top of the cake, wouldn't it, really? Especially as a way to leave. And the type of player he is, the success he's had. And again, it would kind of mark the end of a journey. I mean, ever since the owners came in, the whole reason, whatever they say, the whole reason for getting Guardiola in, maybe to dominate English football, but it's also to take them to the Champions League, to take them to the top of Europe. And it would there would be no better way to mark an ending for David Silva's career there than to win it. And I really think they've got a chance this year, and I'd love to see them do it.
Yeah. And I know, obviously, you were talking earlier on, Gregor, about it all coming down to personal taste, but do you think winning the Champions League would actually somehow immortalise him as one of football's greatest when you consider all of his honours, both at club and international level?
it's really hard to judge that at this moment in time. I think what I was saying about him being quite an understated character kind of counts. It almost counts against you a little bit in those when you're speaking in those terms. I think he's not someone who's ever saw any of that or the limelight or anything. He just loves playing football. So I think winning the Champions League would be, you know, it would mark the sort of the end of, not the end of the journey, but the Manchester City would have kind of come all the way then. In the time he's been at the club, you know, winning the first Premier League title was a huge marker, and they did it again, and he's won everything on English soil. But that would be kind of confirmation of Manchester City as a kind of European heavyweight, and his role on that journey cannot be questioned.
Mm. Now we know, of course, Silva is leaving, but what about the future of John Stones? He played 90 minutes at the Etihad, but had been an unused sub in the previous three games. In a week where Guardiola admitted Stones' future will be decided this summer, with his current deal coming to an end in 2022. I'm honest with them, and the moment I will feel, not with John, but any player, if we have to change, we are going to tell them. That is what Guardiola said. John Stones, of course, joined City in the same summer as Guardiola in 2016, but has struggled for form and fitness under his tenure. It's a difficult one, really, this. Tom, how would you describe John Stones' time at City?
Perhaps underwhelming.
That word I was thinking?
Yeah, we're on the same level again as Thomas Frank.
You can come on again every week.
I think it's a career which has slightly drifted, and I know, especially over the last year, he's had issues off the pitch. But even looking, I remember last year Gareth Southgate talking about John Stones' career, and last summer, and he was talking about Stones in terms of potential, and that was to put it into context. I mean, that was just after the mistake in the semi-final of the Nations League against Holland, and I don't think we should have been talking about Stones in terms of potential by then. And we'll all remember the famous press conference with Guardiola where he spoke about John Stones having more balls than anyone else in the room. He used to really defend him. I don't think there's a player Guardiola has defended in his time at City more than Stones. And I think that is why now hearing Guardiola talk this week about his future, a player who he said would never leave while he was there, I think that represents John Stones' time at Man City really quite nicely, because suddenly you've got 19-year-old Eric Garcia ahead of him now. And this is, I think, the big problem with him as well is a lack of confidence. He's not a Vincent Kompany. He's not a Virgil van Dijk. And it's been a difficult year. There have been injuries, but it's just been a case of drifting, and it's sad to see, really.
Mm. So Tom there saying he's drifting. He's still just 26 years old. So, Gregor, should he be looking to move away from the Etihad?
I think if he wants to play regular football next season, I mean, it's no secret that Manchester City are going to have to sign a centre-back, and he'll likely play alongside Laporte, and Garcia's emerging, so he's way down the pecking order. So if he wants to play regular football, I think he should, yeah. And I agree with Tom. It's kind of pretty fascinating sort of career arc, and I say that arc when he's only 26, as you say. But you know, when he first came through, he almost sort of embodied a bit of a shift in attitude towards English defenders, and you know what they should do, and he would make mistakes, but people would defend them. Say, you know, we want him to play this way. And, you know, remember that time at Everton, he was doing about 12 Cruyffs in his own penalty box and telling the fans to calm down. But that was always, you know, oh no, that's John Stones. He's the future of English defenders, you know. But he never stopped making the mistakes, even after City paid 50 million for him. And he's not really improved. And I think actually that kind of when you look back on that time, I think that the fact that he's a really good footballer, and there's no doubt, and he is, he's a well above average footballer for a centre half. I think that masked the fact that he's not really a natural defender by instinct. And, you know, there are errors where he tries to play out, but there's also errors like the error in the World Cup semi-final against Croatia, where he just completely switched off and Mandzukic ran off his shoulder and scored the winning goal. It's, you know, there's not always a glaring error from him kind of trying to play out from the back or something. Sometimes they are basic defensive errors, and so for that reason, I think he's probably not quite at the level to play in the very best teams in England, internationally, or kind of in Europe, really.
The best period of Stones' career since joining City was probably that the 2018 World Cup in with Southgate. And I think the interesting thing, looking back now in hindsight, and looking at the way teams in the Premier League are playing at the moment, is Southgate played a back three, and you see what Arsenal are doing now, and suddenly David Luiz and Godran Mustafi, they look like such better defenders because a back three protects you so much more. And I think when he's in a two, he struggles so much more.
So just from what you were just saying there, Gregor, you can't see him moving to a top four team if he was to be made available.
I can't see any top four team paying the kind of money that would be required to sign John Stones. And I don't really see them paying for him anyway, actually. I don't know. I don't think so. I think...
So what level? Where
I don't know. It's
fair.
It's going to be difficult for him. He might end up going abroad. I mean, because, you know, it's difficult when you've been on that kind of upward trajectory and you were a regular for England, playing for the best team in the country, won the Premier League. The next step is going to be a big step down, and sometimes that can be difficult for your ego as much as anything. So, you know, he might be someone who goes and plays abroad, and you know, it might be a better fit for him. I certainly would be surprised to see anyone like Arsenal or Chelsea or even a Spurs or anyone like that saying John Stones. No.
Yeah, Tom, do you agree, or do you think there is still a chance for Stones somewhere in either one of the top four teams, or at least in the Premier League? I know Gregor hasn't ruled that out completely, but what do you think?
I think the only team I can see him at, within the elite now, is Leicester. I think Brendan Rodgers is such a good manager, and he gets players and improves them, and I think it could possibly work out there. The issue is whether they, like Gregor said, is how much they're paying for him, because there's no guarantees given what's happened over the last 4 years. He's been quite injury prone. I don't think he's played more than two competitive games in a row since February 2019, I believe I'm right in saying. So that's a big issue. And of course, we have seen City players with that sort of situation, the concern about sort of the ego, going abroad, like Gregor said, I can really see that happening. And Micah Richards spoke about his move to Fiorentina as one of the best things he's ever done in his life as a human being. So I think it would make sense.
Well, you mentioned Chelsea, perhaps, Gregor, that he was unlikely to go there. But let's talk about them, because they capped a good week, which saw them move up to third with a 3-2 win over Crystal Palace. And there's the movement off the field as well, because there's hopes of more incomings at the club, and there's suggestions of Kai Havertz coming in. Now, he's added a major boost to the likes of Chelsea after the highly rated attacking midfielder told Bayer Leverkusen that he wants to leave them this summer. And Tom, you've been writing about Havertz for the Times this week. Real Madrid are also in the market for him as well, the 21-year-old. But Tom, tell us why Chelsea fans should be getting excited.
Well, excited is because of the level of player he is, which we can talk about. But I think the also because of the fact there's real belief that he could end up at Chelsea. And that is because of almost a perfect storm happening, really, and that is because of the economic impact that coronavirus has had. You've got Real Madrid who are very much interested in him. He's considered as one of these players who's still only 21. He's considered as one of these players who could be among the world's best within years. The problem is that the impact of coronavirus on Real Madrid's finances means that they want to push it until to next year. And Havertz doesn't want that. He wants to leave now. Leverkusen obviously didn't qualify for the Champions League either, and he wants to be playing at that level, which is why Chelsea finishing in the top four is so, so crucial. Bayern Munich were also interested in him, but the signing of Leroy Sané meant that they would want to push that back also by a year. So this puts Chelsea as sort of front runner. Leverkusen, because of his potential, see him as valued at around about £90 million, whereas Chelsea are closer to 70. But it's a move you can see happening, and it's because of it would be a big signal of intent, and I think possibly even bigger than that summer when Chelsea bought in Fabregas and Diego Costa. It would probably be one of the biggest sort of transformations since the beginning of the Abramovich era, really.
For those that may not be aware of Kai Havertz, then what sort of a player is he, and who would he then displace in the Chelsea side?
Well, I think that's probably one of the most interesting and compelling topics of how it will turn out, because they've just brought in Ziyech, and Ziyech is the kind of player who plays off the right and cuts in onto his left foot. Well, Havertz is pretty much the exact same position. So they don't necessarily need someone like this, especially because they've got quite a few attacking players now in a similar position. But Havertz, because of his potential and because of how good he is now, I keep talking about potential, but he's such a good player now. It's a case of, if you can get him, go and get him, because he's going to be that good, because he is that good. So I think the concern is possibly, and I think it's why we're seeing the likes of Pedro go, why we're seeing Willian's contract negotiations despite his form being so good, why we're seeing that there's such the uncertainty around his future. But Havertz he's quick, he's strong, Lampard will certainly like him, because the only player that I can kind of compare him to in terms of timing his run into the box is Lampard. He's got a real knack for that. And also Lampard's spoken about a need to have a more physical presence. Well, Havertz isn't your David Silva, your small, nimble artist in there. He's a presence, and that would be key as well. But he creates a lot of chances. He scores a lot of goals. He can play as a false nine. So he's versatile.
Well, do you know, I was just about to ask you about that, because I've been doing a little bit of research on him, and I'm led to believe, like you say, obviously he's plays on the right more often than not, but he can play as a centre forward, an attacking midfielder, everything. That versatility is an added bonus, isn't it, to someone like Frank Lampard, surely?
Completely. And I think it's what I find interesting as well is that there are the players that they're interested in, the players they've signed with Ziyech and with Timo Werner from Leipzig, they are all pretty versatile. And it almost reminds you potentially of what Klopp's done at Liverpool, in that you've got this interchanging front three, a fluid movement of the front three. And I think that's potentially what you could see at Chelsea. Tammy Abraham is obviously more of a focal man up front. But I think there's that rotation, and I think it would be, you know, it would be such a dangerous attack, which Chelsea are, when you think Pulisic, how good Pulisic's been this year, Chelsea are pretty pretty well stocked in that position already.
Yeah, it's only going to add to that sort of free-flowing, pacey attack, and I think other clubs will be wary of him, that's for sure. Along with Timo Werner, Havertz was one of the Bundesliga standout players of last season, scoring 17 goals, claiming 9 assists in all competitions. With the Times also reporting this week that Frank Lampard has stepped up his interest in West Ham midfielder Declan Rice, as they see him as a successor to John Terry in the Chelsea defence. Where else do you think they need improving, Gregor?
A centre-half, left-back and goalkeeper. Simple as
good
that.
Of you.
Yeah, I mean, look, you saw it against Palace on Tuesday. They scored and then Christensen stepped out into no man's land, was skipped beyond, and immediately Palace had brought a score. Immediately Palace had got a goal back. It just seems that Chelsea, I think there was a stat where Chelsea had scored 2 or more goals in the last 8 games, but they'd also conceded more goals than Palace. So, you know, it's no secret that their defence is the biggest issue. And I'd say Kepa, you know, we spoke a bit about David De Gea the other last week, and, you know, his form has suffered, but we know what he's capable of. I'm really not sure that we've seen what Kepa was supposed to be capable of since he's arrived. He's not lived up to his price tag or expectations. And, you know, Zaha's goal was a lovely strike against Palace, but he looked like a little kid who couldn't jump off the floor high enough. He just doesn't look like a presence in the goal. And so I think the goalkeeper is a big issue. Centre half, definitely. Rudiger is someone who is a solid enough defender, but I think Christensen and Zuma are probably not good enough for a Chelsea team that are looking so strong in other areas of the pitch. Chelsea again, they almost conceded an equaliser at the death when Scott Dan hit the post with a header, and then again, even after that warning, there was a through ball to Benteke and Zuma, you know, it was highlighted as this amazing tackle, but he was just left in acres of space. And I think defensively there are huge issues for them still. Mm.
So Chelsea need to bolster their defensive line. If they do that and bring in Havertz as well, Gregor, for you, could you see them as title challengers next season?
I still think that's a huge leap. I mean, there would be no two ways about it. That their attacking options with Ziyech, Werner, as Tom says, Willian, we're slightly unsure about his future, but Pulisic, Hudson-Odoi is not really kind of lifted off the season, but he's still a huge talent. Mason Mount, brilliant breakthrough season, same with Tammy Abraham, Ross Barkley. Loftus-Cheek came back again in the last week, and he had a delightful little pass through for Tammy Abraham. He's a real talent as well. So many attacking players, like an embarrassment of riches. It's just behind that. Even the role of Kante is a big question mark, because, you know, he's often being played in a slightly more advanced role, and it's whether he's comfortable in that. And then if he plays at the base of midfield, where the teams he's played his best football in, but it be that France, the World Cup winning team at France, the Premier League winning team under Conte, the Premier League winning team under Ranieri with Leicester, they were all counter-attacking teams where really they kind of soaked up pressure and sprung forward from that. And I think Chelsea look best when they counter-attack like that, but there have been question marks about his role too. So, you know, basically going forward, it's looking really good for Chelsea. I think there's issues tactically and with the personnel in defence for them to definitely, you know, still big issues if they really want to narrow that gap.
We know, as mentioned, Chelsea will be saying goodbye to Pedro in the summer after he agreed a deal to join Roma. Likely to also lose Willian. We've heard from Tom Roddy there that perhaps unable to agree a new deal at the club. But with all of these incomings and exciting incomings to Chelsea, do you think, Tom, actually keeping hold of someone like Willian would be beneficial still? Because he'll come in, he'll have that experience. He turns 32 in August, and, you know, some of these players aren't old, but Ziyech is 27, Havertz 21, Werner 24. Do you still need to have people in there with Premier League experience?
Perhaps. I think Frank Lampard would love to keep him. I remember Chelsea playing down at at Southampton before the lockdown, and Frank Lampard celebrating Willian coming back and protecting, you know, making a run back as if it was a goal. And I think he really rates his discipline. And I've always been a really big fan of Willian. I think the problem is what they can offer him, because with all these, with the signings coming in, with the potential signings coming in, how much football does a player like Willian, who, as we've seen over the last 2-3 weeks, is still a brilliant player, how much football can you promise him? And the answer is not much. And I think we know from Frank Lampard's style at Chelsea that he's very honest. That is his man management. That's how he's been able to keep Olivier Giroud, Pedro and Willian so true and so good this season, is because he's honest in his approach. And I think that may see Willian leave in the end. But I do think it would be a shame, and I think it would be a big loss as well.
Mm. I suppose the question is, what we need to do right now then, Tom, Gregor, we need to go through a little game. Should we do that? Let's discuss Chelsea and whether or not they need to have a clear out, because clearly Frank Lampard wants to bring in more players at the club, but that's only going to make their squad even bigger. So let's do this. Let's start with Olivier Giroud, who's 33. Do you back or bin, Gregor?
He's just signed a new contract. He's still he's a very handy alternative to the kind of players that Chelsea have. He's an out-and-out centre-forward. They only really have him and Tammy Abraham who fit that bracket, so I would keep him.
All right, so we're keeping him. As per the Coetta, what do you think, Tom?
Oh, back, yes. I mean, they've got Reece James coming through. I think the thing with Azpilicueta is he's another player who's extremely versatile, can play left-back as well. And I'm not complete. I think Reece James is going to be a brilliant player, but I'm not convinced he's as disciplined as Azpilicueta. So back him for now.
Back him for now. Let's turn to Danny Drinkwater. Not had the best of it at Stamford Bridge. So I'm kind of guessing which way you might go with this one, Gregor.
Yeah, but good luck getting him binned. I think, you know, he's earning some pretty good money, and he's unlikely. I think if he's moving on, it'll be on loan again. So, but yes, he's not going to be featuring for Lampard's team next season.
No. Okay. So he gets the bin. Are you backing or binning, Tom, Marcos Alonso?
Binning. I think I'd prefer to see Emerson stick around. Although, having said that, I think it's going to probably be the opposite happening. I think Emerson will end up leaving because he's the preferred player, and I think Alonso will maybe stick around, end up sticking around as backup to whoever they do bring in.
Okay, all right. What about N'Golo Kante? Where do you stand on him?
As if you're asking.
Is this one for me?
Well, I mean, Tom, I'm guessing you want him to stick around by that response, but let's see what Gregor thinks.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, as I say, it's interesting the way he's, since Conte's left, really, he's not had a definitive role, and it's kind of, you know, there have been games where he's flourished, even playing more advanced, but his best position is a holding midfielder in front of the back four, or a destroyer, basically. He's the best in the world at that, and I think any team that can't find room for N'Golo Kante is gonna be some team.
Okay, all right. So that's the back. Definitely. Okay, we're backing him. Okay, so you're backing Kante. Where do you stand on Jorginho? Do we back or bin, Tom?
Blimey, after that last 10 minutes at Palace the other night, you'd be tempted to go for back. But I think we're going to bin, because it's not the he slows down the ball a little bit too much, and that last 10 minutes isn't quite the way Frank Lampard's Chelsea wants to play.
Okay, so Jorginho is out. Rudiger, you kind of alluded to him already, Gregor, but what do you think about him? Are we backing or binning?
I think backing, because, you know, he's experienced as well, and certainly in relative terms compared to Christensen or Zuma. I think either of those two could move on. Perhaps both So I would keep Rudiger. They need at least one centre half, and they need somebody of some experience in that team, because it's certainly very young. A lot of you know, early 20s. So I'd keep him, definitely.
Okay, all right. So he's being kept. Oh, Mishi Bashawai, Tom.
It's a bin, I'm afraid. He's a brilliant character, but it's just never worked out for him at Chelsea. Whoever the highlight was that goal to win the league at West Brom, wasn't it, under the Conte era? But it's just never worked out for him, and it's clear that none of the managers have totally had faith in him. So I think it's time to say goodbye.
Oh, goodbye, Mishi Bashawai. Do we say goodbye or stay, Kovacic, Gregor?
No, I would keep Kovacic. I think he's had a really good season.
Just 26 as well. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. His first season in the Premier League was a bit underwhelming. But and again, he's not a player who kind of lights up the stats. But he is a really good midfielder, and I think he's kind of grown into the team this year, and so definitely a valued member of Lampard's squad.
All right then, Kovacic. Now I know Gregor has already run the rule over Kepa, but Tom, do you agree with what Gregor says? Do Chelsea need a new goalkeeper? If so, are you binning him?
I don't think it's crucial. I think they could challenge or close the gap to Liverpool and Man City with him still in the team. But I think the big problem is actually that I just don't think the defence has any confidence in him. He doesn't come to collect anything. So I think it's a bin. I'd like to see Nick Pope in there instead.
Ooh, interesting. Does that work for you quickly, Gregor, Nick Pope?
Well, he was outstanding against West Ham, and I think he's certainly got a claim for an England jersey now. He looks much more assured than Jordan Pickford, so I wouldn't be surprised if there is some serious interest in him, not necessarily from Chelsea, but from some clubs this summer, definitely.
Just lastly then, Gregor, run the rule over Kennedy. Back or bin?
Bin. I don't need to say any more.
Gregor, is that all you can say to Kennedy? You're harsh. Really interesting that. I think actually Kennedy was the first player in that list, Gregor, that you decided to bin. Up until then, you'd been like, players' union, stick with them.
But, Danny Drinkwater got the elbow.
Well, kind of, but you're a bit like, you can't really get rid of him because of the money that he's on, et cetera. But all right, we'll let you off. Okay. Very quickly, Declan Rice, can he do a job for Chelsea? Could he be someone to help plug the defensive issues that they have, Tom?
I'm not sure. I think so. Yeah, I think so. I don't think when you look at the teams like Man City and Chelsea and Man United, they're sort of in a similar position to Liverpool when they bought Van Dijk in. And that's the big player a lot of them are missing. And Chelsea is certainly, I think if they had a Van Dijk, they'd be a title contender. I don't think Declan Rice is their Van Dijk, but I do think he'd be a big improvement on what they've got.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello, I'm Stig Abel.
I'm Asma Mir, and you can hear our breakfast programme on Times Radio.
Join us as we talk to special guests about everything you need to know for the day ahead.
Listen to our morning show for free on DAB Radio, your smart speaker, at times.radio and via our Times Radio app. Every Monday to Thursday, 6am to 10am on Times Radio. Know your times.
Now, it's fair to say our friend and game podcast regular Matt Dickinson has raised a few eyebrows this week with an article in the Times entitled, "Is switching the club you support really such a crime?" Well, Matt is a QPR fan, but admits, and of course, why wouldn't he, at the envy that he feels as local rivals Brentford prepare for life in their swanky new stadium, and how a potential switch for him and his family would be practical for logistical reasons and probably make for a more exciting life with Brentford pushing for promotion in the Championship, unlike QPR. And Matt explains in the piece that QPR was not his first love. He says, "How many clubs is permissible in a life? Thinking back, I moved from Leeds to Cambridge at about 11. Loyalties were necessarily shifted from one United to another. Through to adulthood, Cambridge became my club through thick and a lot of thin. I remain in regular contact with some involved there, but to cut a long story short, we moved to London. My wife worked at QPR. The kids became attached, and next thing you know, you have three season tickets, a couple of shirts, and are driving to Stoke away. And there are those who would say that changing partners and marriages is easier, more socially acceptable than switching football clubs. I have certainly been told that any more jokes about it will end in punches." This is a big debate, and I can't see anyone agreeing that you should be able to change your club. But let me come to you, Gregor. Is it ever okay to change the club you support?
I have to say, I really enjoyed this piece.
It's very well written, isn't it? Very good.
I texted Matt actually to say as much, and he said that he decided to take a day off social media after posting it online. So, yeah, you can imagine the reaction. So, it was interesting because, you know, the experiences he's had are, you can understand the fact he moved from Leeds to Cambridge, and therefore he became attached to the club. To Cambridge when he was there, and then he moved to London and he became attached to his local club. And people always say you should support your local club. The only issue I have is that really if you are a supporter of a club from childhood, which is often the way, often, you know, your family or your mum or dad or somebody, a brother or sister, it's their fault. That's what it's their fault. They're the reason you support a football club. I feel like it's kind of, it's almost like the first rule of fandom, that once that is embedded within you, and that's kind of, you've made that choice as a child, that there's no going back. So you might develop an affinity with another local club as you move around the country or move somewhere else. But really, I feel like the first club is your one true love. That's the kind of way it has to be. Mm. And I've had a kind of interesting relationship with the team I grew up supporting was Celtic as a boy. I lived in Edinburgh, but my dad was a Celtic fan, so it was his fault. And as I have to say, you know, Celtic are the dominant force now. I went to school when Rangers won 9 in a row. School was torturous for me. You know, I just, every year Rangers won the league, and it was like, oh God, I don't want to go to school today. So, you know, certainly wasn't a glory hunter, but I had a season ticket for a couple of years, and then I started playing football, and I couldn't really go. And then I moved down to Nottingham to play for Forest. And I have to say, you know, Forest was the first club I played for, and I lived in the city for 15 years. So I have a real affinity with Nottingham Forest. I wouldn't say I'm a supporter, but they would probably be the next club I will look for the result on a Saturday. And I also feel that my kind of relationship with Celtic changed, because when you're a professional footballer, it's, I don't know, I have to be delicate in saying this, but it's hard to, you develop a different relationship with fans. Mm. So I found it hard to be as much of a kind of ardent fan of Celtic as the longer I was away from Scotland and the longer I was a professional footballer. But Celtic are still my first club, and that's the club I support. So I don't know, that's a roundabout answer, but I think the answer is no.
Yeah, basically, I think that's what you're saying. You've got it really politely.
It's really complicated, though. It is quite complicated. You know, a lot of people were black and white in their answers, and especially on social media. But Matt, the reason that this got such a good reaction was because it's an interesting subject and a really good call.
It is. And the thing is, I don't know how many people will truly own up to ever switching clubs, for example. But Tom, let's come to you. Do you have your club? Is that the club you've always had as a boyhood fan? Where do you stand on this huge debate?
Yes. I have a club, and I've always sort of stuck with them. But I think Greg.
Are you not revealing them, though, Tom?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But I think Greg summed it up really nicely in saying that you have an affinity to teams. I mean, I went to university in Brighton, and I don't support Brighton, but I certainly want them to do well and have an affinity to Brighton now. But I think the thing with this piece, the way I, Matt logging off social media was because everyone was thinking it was completely ridiculous. And Matt's such a brilliant writer that you come away from his pieces actually thinking a lot about them. And I've never really considered, but it's totally true, the fact that, so-and-so splitting up or getting divorced, it seems ridiculously so much more socially acceptable than so-and-so's decided he's supporting Tottenham this week instead of Arsenal. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's more, I took away from it was just the ridiculousness of it, to be honest. But again, I think it's a no.
The thing is, and I will play devil's advocate in just a moment, but what I will say on this is, obviously, I've made it clear that I'm a Brentford fan. I could never imagine supporting...
Are you?
I could never imagine supporting another club, because that is the club I've kind of grown up loving, and you put yourself through it, you go through the highs and all the lows. That is what it is to be a football fan, in my opinion. And I understood Matt Dickinson's analogy about marriages and things like that, but I don't see it as a marriage with football. I see football as like your best mate, the best mate that you fall out with, you have your moments of hatred with them, you have all that, you have your tearful ups, moments with them, but ultimately you always get back together, you always are best mates, because that's what you are, you're just friends and you go through everything together. But as I say, devil's advocate, there may well be some circumstances that will lead you to perhaps change football teams, whether it is you move location and you do end up going to that local club where you've moved to and starting to build some sort of affinity with that club. Manchester City, West Ham fans argue that perhaps their club is no longer the club they grew up supporting, so they look that some might consider changing who they follow. And also you could look at the likes of AFC Wimbledon and MK Dons. Obviously there are reasons as to why some fans didn't want to go with MK Dons when they moved, obviously, outside of London. So there are some issues, Gregor, that I suppose we do have to factor in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the reasons for divorce have to be all the more severe for football fandom than it would in a relationship.
Yeah.
So, I would say Blackpool's another good example. Blackpool fans spent 4 years, maybe more, refusing to go to a game. They boycotted going to watch their club. But that was done out of love. It was done because they knew the guy at the helm was an odious individual, and he was sort of driving the club into the dirt. Mm. And they were doing what they thought they had to for him to leave. And it was, they were successful in the end. But, but then on the kind of flip side to that is I write the Journeyman column. I've done it for 4 years now, and so I go to a lot of the kind of non-league clubs, and you do get some supporters who are kind of a little bit turned off by the excess and the money and the sort of glitz and glamour of the Premier League, and they kind of want football to be a little bit like it was in the past. It's a little bit, there's closer proximity to the players and to the game itself. So you can understand that as well. I think even someone who was, say, really turned off by as you know, producer Max is a West Ham fan. He will I'll go for West Ham. West Ham have left their home behind, and it seems like they've lost their soul a little bit. So if a supporter decided instead to go and watch Leighton Orient or a non-league team somewhere in London, I think they would still say they were a West Ham fan at heart, but they could feel that they didn't feel the same connection. They didn't feel the same connection to the club that they grew up supporting, so they want to go and get their, they don't want to give them the money either, and so they go and try and get their football fix elsewhere. So I feel that these things are all, you know, there is some nuance to this, but ultimately most fans just hear this subject, the whole idea of changing the club you support, and their blood boils and steam starts coming out of their ears.
Yeah, Gregor, you know that last bit's going to get edited out, yeah?
Max. Cheers, Max.
But let's be honest, just to wrap it up, there are some switches that are just plain wrong. If people are switching allegiances, which I don't agree with in any way, because I do believe you pick your club and that's who you support. But I was speaking to somebody just the other day about this same subject, and they had told me about a friend of theirs who had swapped from being a Derby fan to a Nottingham Forest fan. Gregor, you know that's not right.
Yeah, I mean, that's just nonsense, really. It's kind of, I think, you know, despite everything we've just said, if someone does that, you just feel like they're not really a kind of, they were never a real football fan in the first place.
Yeah. And do you know the reason they said they switched? Because they moved there. It's hardly that far apart, let's be honest.
No,
anyway, do you know what? It's been really interesting. That is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Tom as well. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back with you on Monday. Have a good weekend.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.